When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Heard Tell.
Welcome back to Heard Tell. Thank you so much for giving us the most precious thing you have, your time, as we continue to do what we always do, turn down the noise of the news cycle, get to the information we need to properly discern the times we live in. And the times we live in have been absolutely nuts for the last week or so. I want to talk about the Trump verdict for a minute, but I don't want to talk about the legal ins and outs of it. That's already been hashed out. I don't even want to really talk about the politics of it, because nobody knows. Anybody tells you that they know how this is going to play out, they're not telling you the truth, because this, although we overblow historic, this is historic. It's never happened before. So no, nobody knows how this is going to go, because it's never happened before. We're all guessing. We're all speculating. But I don't really want to talk about the politics and the election part of it. I want to talk about the people's reaction to it. I wrote a piece in the Sunday News Notes and Notions newsletter on the Hurtel Substack, hurtel.substack.com, free to subscribe. And it got a really strong reaction. So I actually put it on Ordinary Times as well, just to let another audience see it. And it got an even stronger reaction. I want to talk about the reaction of people to this verdict, specifically some of the Trump support folks. I know who Donald Trump is. We had a lot of book on Donald Trump when he ran for office in 2015. He'd been all over tabloid media. He'd been a reality TV host. He had been omnipresent in culture. He's been around for a long time. Everybody knows who Donald Trump was. He had very high name recognition. Now he has 100% name recognition because he was president. But anything you wanted to know about Donald Trump, and I'm repeating some stuff I've been saying for years here, so just bear with me. There was nothing about Donald Trump to make a judgment on what kind of man Donald Trump was that wasn't available in 2015 and when folks went to the polls in 2016 or when they went to the polls in 2020. Or as they go to the polls in 2024, there's even less excuse. Everything you wanted to know about Donald Trump was out there. Did people read the book that we had on Donald Trump? Well, some of them did. Some of them didn't. Some of them only picked out the stuff they wanted. And then there are the folks that become enablers. If you want to give me the story that, well, I supported Donald Trump because I don't think he's a good guy and I don't think this isn't this, but here's my reasons, 1, 2, 3, why I supported him anyway. Okay, that's a reasoned argument. I'll hear you out on that. I voted or didn't vote for Donald Trump because of X, Y, Z, and here's my reasons. That's a well-reasoned position. Let's hear it out. We'll hash it out. I'll go with that. Donald Trump doesn't get a lot of those reactions, though. Donald Trump gets a lot of projected upon him reactions. I watched evangelical Christians go gaga over Donald Trump and swear up and down he was a new Christian or a baby Christian or a converted Christian, despite all evidence to the contrary and the man himself saying he never asked for forgiveness. They projected what they wanted onto him because they thought he was going to give them things that they wanted. And maybe they got some of those things. They got Supreme Court justices. Roe v. Wade got overturned because of those Supreme Court justices. So if you were doing it as a trade, fine. Politics is a trade-off system is not a unheard of thing, but admit that's what it was. You were projecting that onto him. And people that are against Trump sometimes lose their mind over who he is and make it more than what it is. Let me level with you. I didn't vote for Donald Trump. I will not vote for Donald Trump. I think he was bad for the country for a lot of reasons. I think it's been proven out that he's been bad for the country for a lot of reasons. There is nothing that he accomplished, if you are a conservative or Republican or whatever you want to call yourself, there's nothing he did that you wouldn't have gotten from an average run-of-the-mill conservative Republican of any kind of stripe, even probably a moderate one, would have got you pretty much the exact same stuff. So I don't buy the argument that you had to have Donald Trump to get X, Y, and Z done, because any other Republican probably would have nominated the same people, would have gotten the same stuff done, probably would have gotten even more done, because Donald Trump was rather incompetent when it came to legislative maneuvering. But you decide that how you want to. What I want to talk about with this verdict, though, is the real hardcore enablers, the true believers, the sycophants. I'm talking about the people who completely changed everything they believed in and proclaimed to believe in their public stuff once Donald Trump became ascendant. Talking about, and I don't want to pick on people here, but let's call them who they are, the people that ran against Donald Trump in 2016, the Ted Cruzes and the Marco Rubios, who said one thing and crafted public images, but then once Trump is in power, they just take all that, set it aside, and become Trump supporters because they know they got to, because they would lose the Trump voters and Trump supporters' support, and they don't have the courage or the conviction to stick with what they claim to be for. Once Donald Trump came along, they just modified and tried to mesh it all together. People have a hard time believing that. Comes off hypocritical. At least it does to me. Lots of other people as well. So you can think what you want about the Donald Trump verdict. The truth is, legally, he's going to have a good case on appeal because people across the spectrum, progressive lawyers, moderate lawyers, conservative lawyers, some of the underlying legal stuff on this conviction is going to be subject to appeal, and there's going to be a good argument on some of this, the way they elevated the felonies, the underlying charges, that sort of thing. That's legalese that we'll get into with a lawyer at some point. But yeah, he's entitled to an appeals process here. The two bands to this conviction, though, is there's the political arguments and the legal arguments. All of Donald Trump's grievances as a citizen, he's entitled to bring up on appeal. But he has political grievances that he's thrown out that don't really have anything to do with the legalese. He can't get a fair trial in New York. No, he was tried by a jury of his peers, 12 of them, including one who said their sole source of news was True Social, whether you believe him or not. There's something like 500,000 registered Republicans in New York City. So even though it's deep, deep blue, yeah, you can get a jury with some Republicans on it. That's a political argument that doesn't match the legalese. His lawyers got to do jury selection just like everybody else. If the judge did anything detrimental in conduct, that'll be brought up in appeal. That's a political argument that doesn't match the legalese. Most people of good faith said this judge handled this about as well as you could, even with Donald Trump attacking him nonstop. So you can have opinions on all that. Here's who I judge harshly. I know what to expect from Donald Trump. Donald Trump railing against the verdict doesn't bother me very much. And I wrote about this. I'll link to the piece. The thing that bothers me is the sycophants and the Greek chorus, I called them, of people who are just going to latch onto Donald Trump no matter what. The senators and the congresspeople and the other politicos that showed up at his trial, they say they're showing up to support him. They're not showing up to support him. They're showing up to try to get some shine off him. Shine's an old wrestling term. Professional wrestling, if you had somebody up and coming, you'd put them with the champion or one of the big names, and they'd get shine off that. It would elevate them just being in their stratosphere. These are people who have decided that everything that was, you know, good and integrity in their own careers, they're just going to light that on fire to light the way of Trump. I don't understand that thinking. I can't even get my mind around it. Oh, I understand money and power and ambition and all that, but I can't imagine lighting my whole reputation on fire over Donald J. Trump. But that's because I paid attention to who Trump was before 2015, and I just don't buy what Donald Trump sells and says because it doesn't match his actions. And the actions he does have and the things he is being honest about, I think, are bad for the country. Oh, I know Biden has bad problems too, but let's stick to Trump for just a second. See, this is the core of this conviction problem. Trump doing bad things is on Trump. Other people doing bad things and getting away from them doesn't make Trump less guilty, less bad, less knowing what he's doing. This is somebody who's pushed the system for years. He loves litigation. He's been in court all of his professional career. He loves suing people. He loves doing bankruptcy. He loves pushing the rules. He loves pushing the boundaries. He likes skirting laws and getting away with it. Here's the thing. When many, many people in his inner circle now are convicted felons for very different things. The CFO for his company is a convicted felon for the way the company's run. No, the world's not out to get you. You may be reaping the whirlwind of people out to get you, but you also started a lot of that whirlwind with your decision-making. Donald Trump asked for this attention. He thumbed his nose at authority in the law for decades. He demanded to be treated differently. He demanded to have the rules changed for him. He's always been above the law. So it rings really hollow to me when he gets convicted that, oh, everybody's out to get me. Well, yeah, but you kind of demanded that they were because you liked it. You liked the attention. You liked the money. You liked the power. So I don't buy that argument. Donald Trump's not a victim here. Yes, we have a two-tiered justice system. Donald Trump is in the upper part of it. How can you tell? Well, he got in a multi-car motorcade after he was convicted and went back to the luxury penthouse in the high-rise building that he owned. That's not how normal convicts get treated. He didn't have to get sucked into a bail system like a lot of people do that turned them into career people that are stuck in the system because they can't make bail or pay bail, or they get charged a bunch of court fees they can't pay and it sucks them into the system they can't ever get out of. Something more personal, though, Donald Trump saying he's the victim here is an insult to many, many people who have been wrongfully convicted, who really didn't do very much wrong or were overcharged or overzealous prosecutors. I know people personally that lost years of their life in prison, and even the people that prosecuted him came back and said, oh, we shouldn't have charged him and he shouldn't be in prison, but it's the federal system and there's no parole and it'll take 6 or 7 years to get it overturned. So just do your 5 years and oh, well, sorry. This rhetoric around Donald Trump is insulting to people like that. The justice system has a lot of problems. If you're new to it, great. If Donald Trump brought you to it, great. But be clear-eyed about what it is. Donald Trump has gotten preferential treatment throughout this sin. I still don't think he's probably going to get jail time. If he does, it'll be minimal. And he'll have probationary. Look, this is a man who still gets to travel and campaign while in court for very serious charges. Normal people don't get that. The truth is Donald Trump has gotten a lot of slack from the system. So the first time that the system slaps his wrist, I'm not buying the argument that he's a victim. And again, don't have any hot takes on this that you can't take back if this conviction gets overturned on appeal, because there's a very good chance at least part of it might get overturned on legal grounds. He's going to have a case. He has that right as a citizen. Here's what Donald Trump doesn't have a right to do, though. He doesn't have a right to say the whole system is against him as an insult to people when we do have a broken system that is abusing and ruining people's lives, that don't have millions of dollars, teams of lawyers, millions of adoring fans, and the name former president to get him a motorcade and other things that most people don't get in the justice system. One more thing I want to bring up on this with the verdict and judging the reaction of people more so than just the legalese and the politics of the verdict. Donald Trump was very upset. This is reported. This is not my opinion. He thought there would be massive protests outside of his trial, and there wasn't, outside of the New York Young Republicans doing their staged little bit of theater and the day of the conviction itself. Look, this isn't my opinion. I talked to reporters on the ground directly. There wasn't very many people protesting this. There was a handful, usually about a dozen or so every day out there, and there wasn't even really that many counter protests. Now, that's why Trump was railing about the security measures, but there's plenty of places people could protest. People didn't turn out to protest the way he thought they would. There was no rioting after this conviction, like some people had said and Trump himself had hinted at. There was no rioting. There was no massive protest. There was a lot of noise in social media, but there wasn't any big protest. You saw the money people making money and they had the fundraising ready to go on social media. But there was no protest. There was no mass outcry at this conviction. There was nobody in the streets. Why? And Trump is already building up that if he gets sentenced in July, that there'll be massive riots and there'll be massive protests. I don't think there will be either. Why? Keep Trump's popularity in perspective. In 2020, he did get just under 47% of the vote. 46.8, depending on which number you want to use. Let's round it off to 47%. Oh, that's a big number. That's that's half of the 66% of people that voted and turned out. And that was a high turnout election. So really, how popular is Donald Trump? He's very loud in news media because for and against Donald Trump drives news media. It's the biggest business model for news media, podcasting, radio, TV, what I'm doing. You want numbers? Put Trump's name on it. For and against, you'll get numbers. But let's break down his popularity. He's half the country didn't vote for him. 47% of 66% of eligible voters did. You know how many eligible voters there were in 2020? 270 million. He got 74 million of those votes. That's about 27%. Out of the entire population of America, he only got 22%. Of people that actually went out and voted for him in 2020. And those numbers were up from 2016. How popular is Donald Trump really? About 22% of all Americans came out and voted for him before January 6th happened, before the Georgia runoffs happened, before all the chaos of the last 4 years, before this criminal conviction, before the other cases that are pending, although I don't think any of them are going to get settled. And frankly, this appeal probably won't be settled before Election Day 2024. Just put that in perspective. Donald Trump is really, really loud, but he's never been as popular as either his supporters or his detractors or the news media and social media money machines that depend on him think he is. He's just the center of the business models and political world right now. But his actual popularity isn't that high. That's why you didn't see massive protests. That's why you didn't see riots. And you probably won't going forward. Donald Trump, after going into year 9 of Donald Trump as a national politician since he announced that run in 2015, it's starting to run out of steam, folks. And all this drip, drip, drip is going to add to it. That doesn't mean he may not get elected. He may. But keep in perspective how popular he really is when everybody goes doomsdaying about Donald J. Trump. More Hurt Tell right after this.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
Welcome back to Herd Tell. Let's talk about this Caitlin Clark situation. We're not going to break down NBA games, although I've watched quite a few WNBA games this season. I've been watching most of Caitlin Clark's games and a few of the other ones because I found it interesting. I watched a lot of the women's college tournament this past time because I found it interesting. It was compelling. There were storylines. There was rivalries. There was big college programs, big personalities, not just in the players with Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese and people like this, but the coaches, Dawn Staley and others, you know, big, big stories, big personalities, good competition. I enjoyed it and I got to watch it with my kids. My now 18-year-old daughter really likes basketball, so she'll come in and we'll sit down and watch a Caitlin Clark game. I've watched all these games. I watched the game that folks are fussing about with the cheap shot, and that's what it was. It was a cheap shot, but, you know, it's happened in basketball before. And I watched her latest game as we're recording this. They're getting ready to go on a break where they're not going to play for, I think it's 5 days or so. They played 11 games in 20-some days, something like this. It's been a brutal schedule. Caitlin Clark played very poorly, worst game she's had as a pro. And even with her worst game as a pro, she's had very favorable numbers through her first set of games. But that's not really what this is about. This isn't really about a basketball story, although it's contained in basketball. What we're seeing happen in social and news commentary media over Caitlin Clark is a very teachable moment. what is happening is there's basically two groups of people. There's people that want to talk about the Caitlin Clark situation as it is, what it means to women's sports, women's basketball, the WNBA, the Indiana Fever, the team she plays for, just dealing with it as it is. And then there's this other group that wants to talk about what they always want to talk about anyway, or are monetized talking about. They're just using Caitlin Clark as the excuse to do it. So what do I mean by that? Sports media has a habit of making people do and say really dumb hyperbolic things. People, especially men, let's just be honest here, especially men of a certain age, lose their minds over sports. They just take reason and set it to the side and completely lose all semblance of anything when it comes to sports. Some of that's natural. It's competition. You love your team, especially something like college. You may have lineages that go back generations to a college team or a sports team. People with their NFL teams, NBA teams, baseball teams. Maybe you go back a long way. I'm not a Reds fan by accident. My grandfather's a Reds fan. My dad took me to Reds games, even though he was actually a Yankees fan because he grew up in the 50s. And the only team you could hear on the radio was the New York Yankees, the Mickey Mantle era Yankees, because they were the biggest thing going. So my dad actually grew up a Yankees fan, but all my family was Reds fans. So my dad took me to Reds games in the summertime. We'd go to the old riverfront. I didn't accidentally become a Reds fan. I certainly didn't accidentally become a WVU fan. If you ever watch the videos, there's WVU stuff right behind me. I'm sitting here wearing a WVU polo shirt right now. Frankly, if I'm doing a talking head segment and you see me in a shirt and tie and coat, I'm probably in my WVU gym shorts or sweatpants underneath that, because those are the advantages of working from home. I am privileged. I admit it. But I didn't become a WVU fan by accident. WVU is kind of the state team. We don't really have professional sports teams in West Virginia. My dad went there. Lots of people went there. It's part of the identity of the state. So it wasn't accidental that I was a WVU fan. So I'm very passionate about WVU and the Cincinnati Reds and other sports teams that I support. But you have to have self-awareness about that. What we're seeing in sports media and cultural commentary media, however you want to call that, especially, let's just call it cultural commentary media, the people that monetize the culture wars, they're taking the Caitlin Clark situation, and sports has starting to figure out that the culture war stuff combined with sports is ratings gold, is viewing gold, is clicks in abundance. If you can combine those two things, there's a couple practitioners of this. We're not going to name them because this isn't just about flame-throwing people. But if you can combine the culture war political stuff with passionate sports, you have a formula for monetization and making money and getting lots of attention. And this Caitlin Clark story fits that mold perfectly because there's a lot going on here. The healthy way to talk about the Caitlin Clark story would be thusly. Women's sports in America in the last 20, 25 years has gone leaps and bounds forward. They have made massive progress. Go watch early WNBA games from when the league first formed and watch the games that have been played in the last few days. It's not even the same sport. The college game is elevated. The lower leagues are elevated. The high school level is elevated. That's not accidental. The growth in women's sports, whether it's professional basketball, the women's soccer game, which got really big, the women's national team gets extremely good ratings over the last few years for a lot of reasons. Those things build over time. And what you have now in the WNBA and in women's soccer and in other women's sports, you have one or two generations now that have grown up with a lot of money being invested, with things like middle school and high school programs getting money and funded, with colleges spending more money and getting more funding, and it's becoming more athletic, more physical, and a better product to watch for the casual fan that doesn't always watch women's sports. I'm one of them. I don't normally watch WNBA games over the last few years. Might have watched a few here and there, but I never sought them out. I've been watching them this year, not just because of the Caitlin Clark, but because of the stories going on around it. And it's a good product. The women's NCAA tournament was compelling. You got drawn into it because of the storylines. Sports is not just sports. Sports is everything that goes on around the sports, the storylines, the personalities, the competition. That plays into this Caitlin Clark thing. The mature way to deal with it is go, yes, the Caitlin Clark story has some things going. There's gender, female roles and issues. There's competition, the sport. And of course, it'd be idiotic not to admit that there's racial components to it. Caitlin Clark, Iowan, Iowa girl, went to Iowa, you know, white that all has a part too in a league that has predominantly black players in it. This stuff all can be talked to in a positive way where you go, this is a good time to talk about race issues and sports issues and gender issues and female issues and competitive sports issues. That's the mature way to do it. But the content creators that are not of good faith, that cultural media folks, we talked about it, they're taking this and slamming it into what they always do. Division, bad stuff, accusing they and them and the other side. They're using this to talk about what they've always wanted to talk about. If they have racial biases, prejudices, and bigotry, they're using this as an example to do that, but they can say Caitlin Clark instead of saying white versus black. There's a lot of that going around. There's people that have a problem with women's sports in general. They're using this, but they can talk about Caitlin Clark and they don't have to admit what they're really talking about. And then there's other things that are maybe not quite as hot button, but like people talk about the pay of the NBA. Well, if you watch the game and you support it and you buy the merchandise and the TV ratings go up, the players in the WNBA are going to get more money. That's how those things work. Yes, Caitlin Clark is going to get a big contract, but some of the other big name players will also start getting bigger contracts because of more eyeballs. That's how those things work. So do you want to have a productive conversation about this and the heavy issues that underpin all this? Or do you want to just be part of the problem and yell and scream about whatever your own little biases and prejudices are and just use Caitlin Clark as an excuse to yell even louder about it because you think you can get away with it because you can wink, wink, nudge, nudge, not talk about what you're really wanting to talk about? I want to be productive. I want to make things better. I want WNBA players to get more money, to get more endorsement deals, for more people to fill the stands, and for the league to be successful, because I think that's good for a lot of people. I'm a girl dad. It's really cool for my daughters to go, oh, I get to watch women's basketball on TV with my dad and enjoy it. That's a good thing for society. It's a good thing for women. It's a good thing for the girls watching it. But if we start putting all our culture-warring nonsense on top of it and jamming it into that and then pretending like it's just sports on one hand, while on the other hand, jamming all that cultural crap on it so that we can get more hits, clicks, and views, what have we really done? You're not helping the game. You're not helping Caitlin Clark. You're not helping the other players in the league. You're not helping anybody but yourself get attention. And in the long run, people are going to notice what you're doing, and you're really not helping yourself because what you're really doing is revealing things. Hot button stuff like the Caitlin Clark stuff just reveals things. It lets people reveal about them. Let's believe what people are telling us. So if people want to take this in really ugly directions and not only tell us, but scream it at us with repetition and then hide behind the sport of basketball and women's basketball and Caitlin Clark to act like that's not what they're doing, they're telling us something about themselves. We should believe them and adjust our media and social media intake accordingly and prune them out so we can enjoy the game and grow the game and have positive conversations that move the ball forward on things like race and gender and sports, and not let the worst of us and the loudest voices that are the worst of us dominate a conversation that really is worth having, that is more than just telling the girls to shut up and dribble and the men to shut up and dribble when it comes to them and the ladies of the WNBA to shut up and dribble, because that's not the world we live in anymore. They have a right to say whatever they want. We can counteract that. But that's a lot better than what I've been seeing in the media over this Caitlin Clark stuff, where people are revealing the problems in their own character and their own worldviews way more than any problem they're showing with the WNBA. More Hurt Tell right after this. Welcome back to Hurt Tell. June the 6th, whenever you're listening to this, I'm recording it a day or two prior, is the anniversary of D-Day. This is going to be the 80th anniversary. If you go on any kind of social media or news media or anywhere online, you will see all sorts of videos of the veterans. There's a huge concerted effort in the U.S., the U.K., and France to get as many of the living veterans as possible to the D-Day remembrances this year. There's a lot of reasons for that. One is we're almost out of them. All of these men are 100 or very close to it that were actual participants France is making a big deal out of it. The UK, America is flying over as many as we can. This will be the last major anniversary to have any kind of a number of the actual veterans there. This has happened throughout history. We have a little bit of video of the Gettysburg veterans on their 80th anniversary, the famous video of them meeting at the wall and shaking hands, recreating Pickett's charge. That was the last big group meeting of those veterans, and we were lucky enough to have it on film. This is going to be the last of this generation getting together for June 6th. I was struck watching these men go through the airports on the honor flights leaving, because almost all of them are in wheelchairs or walkers of some sort. You know, they're all 100 years old or really close to it. Some of them way over. I think the oldest one I saw is 107 that's going to be traveling. They're sitting in wheelchairs. They're old. They're aged. They're physically decrepit. But all of modern civilization rests on their shoulders still what they did. The reason we obsess over World War II is it is one of the cases in history where you have very clear-cut good guy, bad guy. The good guys won. Some of the greatest evil in state form in Nazi Germany we've ever seen on the planet was defeated. And not just the war stuff, the Holocaust stuff, the fascism, the just all that bad that went into Nazi Germany. And we can talk about the historical ramifications at some other part. Yes, I know Stalinist Russia was an ally and turned into the Cold War. We'll deal with that another time. But when you talk about D-Day, it was the beginning of the end for Germany, whereas it's just one of those real clear-cut moments in history where you can go, these men changed the world, and they did it through their bravery. So it's amazing to honor them. So I wanted to share a story. I was in London on the 60th anniversary of D-Day, 2004. I didn't mean to be in London because it was D-Day. I just happened to have a couple days off. I was stationed in Frankfurt, Germany at the time. Got a flight, went to London for a couple days of rest and relaxation because my boss literally told me, you're taking a couple days off. You're a workaholic. You need some time off. And I'd just gone through a lot of really intense personal things before that. Something I don't talk about a lot, but I was newly sober. I'd quit drinking. I'd been through rehab, that sort of thing. So they're like, you know, take some time, go over to London. So I went to London. I was in London for the D-Day celebrations. I completely by accident wound up on the HMS Belfast. That's the destroyer that's permanently moored in the River Thames. Right beside the Tower Bridge. And by total accident, I was there, and I could tell something was going on up on the fantail of the ship. And what happened was one of the production companies had a large contingent of UK D-Day veterans on the ship, and they were shooting interviews with these UK veterans on the ship on the fantail. They had an awning set up, a little studio kind of situation. They were bringing them in and sitting them down and interviewing them for the 60th anniversary. And I just wandered into this by complete accident. I didn't know what was going on. And, you know, I was active duty at the time. So I just kind of wandered in. And the veterans that were waiting were in chairs, and they had, you know, most of them were even, this is 20 years ago, and they were all elderly there. So you can imagine how old these guys are now. So they had people with them, and they were giving them water. It was a rather warm day, and it's, you know, out in the sun. So they had awnings set up for them and things like this. And one of the great privileges and honors of my life is I got to spend several hours just sitting there talking to these UK D-Day vets. Now, I'm of the age when I was, you know, little and growing up, almost every elderly man, you just assume they were a World War II veteran, because almost all those guys that were, you know, 70, 80 years old when I was growing up as a kid, 60, 70, 80 years old, almost all of them served in some capacity. My maternal grandfather was a World War II veteran. We all knew that. We knew those stories. We know he'd been in the Navy. We had those letters that he had written. We had the picture of my maternal grandmother, one of the few trips out of West Virginia she ever take, up in New York City when he was, you know, getting ready to deploy, and got a picture of them on a roller coaster at Coney Island, one of the great highlights of her entire life, getting to go to New York City. Because he was the plank holder on a destroyer, they manned it in Maine, went to New York City to commission it, and then they sailed it all the way to Tokyo Bay over the course of the next 2 years. But the new generations didn't grow up like that. My kids may not have ever met very many World War II vets at all. They didn't grow up knowing that generation of people that I did, where they were the dominant generation as the older generation when I was a kid. And now there's some estimates that we only have like 100,000 of them left in the U.S. out of the millions and millions that served. Time doesn't stop. But when I spent that afternoon in London talking to the UK vets, which was, you know, a privilege because I knew a lot of the U.S. vets, something amazing happened that I'm going to get emotional just talking about this, but it was such an honor because you start talking to these men and you revere them and what they did. And to a man, they downplay it. I got to talk to one British gentleman. The way he described what he did, it was like he was talking about taking a shift at a factory. It was just my job. It was just my job to go in and do this. It's just what we did. You know, we had to do it. We got it done. Like, so matter of fact, how humble these men were. And they're sitting there, and in the British tradition, they're dressed up and they have their medals on their chest from their service. And some of them had berets on of their various services. Some of them had uniforms of various descriptions, but they all wore their medals. And you see these elderly men, and some of them had a lot of medals. And you're just staring at them like, my God, this is a special breed of men. But they repeatedly would tell you, nope, I was just doing my job. Everybody had to pitch in. It was different for the UK vets, too, because remember, London went through the Blitz. England was being bombed. There was a very big thing of, was Germany going to invade England, and was England going to fall? England was standing alone in the world for quite a while. These sorts of things. You know, Nazi Germany had all of Europe. They conquered France. They had a very different perspective of the war than the American veterans I'd talked to. And then something really remarkable happened that showed the humility and the brotherhood of service people. You know, I'm a nobody. I did a little time in Iraq, but we're not really frontline troops. The things that happened to us were things that, you know, just kind of happened. We weren't meant to be in those situations. But when they found out that you're an active duty person at the time, all of a sudden the conversation changes. And you have all these questions you wanted to ask them, and they started barraging me with questions about what the service was like now, what Afghanistan was like, what Iraq was like. I'd just gotten back from a short deployment that I don't want to talk about. It lost a friend in April of, this was in June, and that had just happened in April. It was still really, really raw. But they wanted to know about it, but they didn't want to know about the combat stuff. They didn't want to know about the fighting. You know what they wanted to know about? They wanted to know about the food. They wanted to know about the planes, the travel. And because I did air mobility stuff, I talked to them about what a C-17 was like. These D-Day vets were, they were asking me all these questions about what's it like on a C-17? What's it like to do that sort of stuff? They wanted to know about the food. They were just obsessed over the little living details of being in the military. How much had changed? And how much had not changed. They wanted to know about the food. They wanted to know about the uniforms. They wanted to know about traveling and the air travel and the kit and what kind of weapon you carried and the kind of things. And they talked about how horrible their boots were and how their feet were already tore up. And they thought we had better boots. That was one conversation that I'll never forget. He's like, oh, y'all have it easy. You have proper boots. We had terrible boots. And you stop and think about it. And you're like, no, yeah, he's right. We got it pretty good. You wanted to put up your hands and just stop them and go, why are you talking to me? I'm a nobody. You're not only the greatest generation, you're the D-Day vets. You did one of the most epic things in all of history. But then it hits you. They're talking to you like a peer. They're showing you the ultimate, I'm going to get touched. They show you the ultimate respect, even though you're nowhere near on their level. But in their mind, they just did their job. And our generation was just doing our job, and to them it was all the same. That's more of a testimony than anything I can write or say of how that generation viewed that. They were just doing their job. They expected the generation after them to do their job. They knew the generation before them did the job, and that's how they viewed it. We know a lot more now about things like PTSD, of stress, of war damage to the body, what it does to you. Trust me, I'm a frequent VA patient. I feel my service and the things related to it every time I move, breathe, or try to keep a thought in my head without losing it. But there's something very noble, even in working on the mental health aspects and the healthcare and veterans benefits and all those things we advocate and fight for. There's a very noble lesson to learn in that they didn't try to blow up their own accomplishments, even though they got one of the great scoreboard events of all history. They almost, to a man, never made it about themselves. They just said, we did the job, and if you were in our place, you would have done the same. I really hope that's true. I hope the coming and rising generation rises to whatever challenge the way they did and the way we tried to. World's a messy, ugly place. And as this generation passes into history, and we observe this last major gathering on a major anniversary of the D-Day veterans and the World War II generation, that, you know, within the next few years, we'll read the headline that the last one's gone. We need to remember that part of it, that to them, the important part was that they were just part of a long, unbroken line that they made sure they weren't the break link in. And that's a lesson we should take from them as we honor them. I can't think of anything more honorable than that, more true to duty than that. More Hurtel right after this. Welcome back to Hurtel. Let's talk about India. Let's go way over yonder for just a second. I talk about India on this program. By the way, we're on a couple podcasting platforms in India. How y'all doing? We see you. Thank you so much for listening. Prime Minister Narendra Modi won his third term in India, but his party suffered losses. That's the headline in the New York Times. Indian politics are very complicated. And one of the things is it's the largest democracy on earth. You're talking about, you know, a billion people. India is now the largest country on earth by population. That makes it the largest democracy. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of, India has always been an amazing country to study. Modern India is getting ready. There's something that's getting ready to happen in India worldwide that I just want to talk about for a second. They're the biggest population on earth now. They're a regional competitor with places like China because they have such a massive untapped economy, and China's economy is far ahead of where India's is. So as China's economy starts falling off and India has surpassed them in population, what you want to watch for economically going forward is there's so much growth potential in the Indian economy because of that massive workforce and the room for growth as they modernize that you could really be seeing a huge change. You may see a huge cultural change worldwide out of India. We already know that, you know, Bollywood has started to creep in. You see more and more of that. Things like the RRR movie a few years ago got really, really big. Just a few weekends ago in DC, they had a massive Punjabi concert that sold out, and the videos of that were amazing. I don't think the world is prepared, and especially the American world, is prepared for the cultural landslide of a billion Indians being more online and more globalized. It's going to be a thing. So we talk about India. We're actively, you know, cultivating some sources in India because this is going to be a major player in the world politically, culturally, economically going forward. And although there's some issues with the Modi government that we can hash out some other time, unlike China, they are a democracy. So they don't have some of the issues going on with China where, you know, you have the repression of its own people. They disappear people, they're committing genocide against the Uyghurs, things like that. Now, India has its own issues. They're having some really ugly stuff between, you know, the majority Hindus and the minority Muslims and other sects. The Sikh stuff up in Canada and here in America, where you actually have some assassinations and accusations with that stuff. But India is something you really need to pay attention to understand how the modern world is working. And culturally, they're going to seep in more and more. And that's how a lot of people will start noticing it. But politically, economically, geopolitically, we need to pay attention to India. Now that we know that, you know, Modi has another term here, we know pretty much where he is. He's had Donald Trump over. He's been over with President Biden. America needs to have a good allyship with India. Now, it's not going to be a perfect one. It's going to be messy. A couple of years ago, they had the brouhaha where we had to kind of turn a blind eye why they bought Russian military equipment, even though they're our ally. Because practically a lot of their equipment is Russian, and if you didn't let them, you know, keep up their own stuff, they're going to have a problem. And the idea was, we'll wink, wink, nudge, nudge this one, and hopefully they'll buy more stuff from us in the future. Stuff like that's really complicated, and it has huge ramifications going forward. China, Russia, India needs to be an ally of the U.S. in those sorts of things, and it's something that's not going to happen automatically. We have to have economic incentives, political incentives, and we got to have those friendships and allyships built into the cake. So if you don't know what's going on in India, time to start reading up on it. Time to start paying attention of it. You don't have to watch it day to day and pay attention all the time. Put a couple people in your news feed that's covering India. Put a couple news sources, reputable ones, BBC, India News, other things. And we're going to start having more contributors on to Talk India from time to time, because this is going to be a huge thing in the next 10, 15, 20 years and a big shift in global politics, global economics, and also in the culture. It's a big world out there. It's foolish to pretend like it's not. India is going to be a major player going forward. Go ahead and get on that train now so that you're ahead of the curve. More Herd Tell right after this.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
Going back to Herd Tell. Okay, let's end on a good note because there's been some heavy stuff. Let's go out to Wichita, Kansas via CNN news source, KAKE, Wichita, Kansas. The parents of a baby girl said they are thankful to a Kansas State trooper who saved their daughter's life on Mother's Day, leading to the discovery that she needed heart surgery. At just 18 days old, Brexley Huffman stopped breathing the morning of May 12th as she and her parents, Cal Huffman and Gracie Gray, were driving to church. Kansas Highway Patrol Trooper Evan Jacks, who was on patrol just yards away from the family parked, rushed to help. Quote, I work in the medical field, but when it's your own child, it's different, said Gray, the mother. But it was a huge relief when Evans was close as he was. Jacks performed life-saving measures and got the baby girl breathing again. Brexley was taken to the hospital where her parents learned she had a series of heart defects that had previously not been known as Schoenis syndrome, and needed open heart surgery. She underwent the successful surgery the following Thursday at Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City, Missouri. We're just so thankful we gotten to this point. She's on the road to recovery, Huffman said, Brexley's father. The amount of prayers and support we've gotten from everybody, people don't even know, probably will never know. It's just truly heartwarming. After Brexley's surgery, her parents took the opportunity to thank Jax for his heroic actions. Quote, we're just so grateful he was there, and we know he's an amazing guy. He's always going to have a special place in our hearts and our daughter's hearts. Without him, it's hard to tell what would have happened. So he's a heck of a guy. There's been a GoFundMe set up for the baby, even with the successful open heart surgery. Obviously, that's a long road of recovery for a child that's only basically 2 months old now at this point. But a wonderful story. A lot of good folks out there. Listen, if you've never taken basic first aid, CPR, how to use an automatic defibrillator, Heimlich maneuver, make sure you do that. It's free all over the place. Most municipalities and hospitals and places, you can find free courses that will teach you basic things like CPR, basic first aid, Heimlich maneuver. These things save lives. And if you're not going to do that, at least know, have numbers in your phone, how to call highway patrol, state troopers, sheriff's departments, your local police department, have multiple numbers in there. Always know what to do in the event of an emergency. You may be the only hope somebody has in a life-saving emergency. At least know how to get help. And if you can take that extra step, figure out how to be helpful yourself. You never know when you may need to use it. You never know when you'll come across a car wreck, somebody in medical distress. Make sure you know how to call 911 and distinctly give information like location and some basic life signs. Make the world a better place by making sure you keep more people in it, if so called to do so in a life-saving situation. That'll do it for Heard Tell. We so appreciate you. We got a couple really good episodes already recorded, getting ready to edit them, get them out. We'll talk a little UK politics, going to talk the internet and how people want to gatekeep it to keep for the children. Stop me if you've ever heard that one before. Reaching out to some political stuff, of course, but also some important cultural stuff, some history stuff we want to cover. You get it all for free. However you're listening to the broadcast, iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio. We're on Spreaker now. We're on a couple of places over in India. We're on UK podcasts. Anywhere you can get a podcast, just type in Heard Tell Show, type in Andrew Donaldson. We should come right up. Make sure you subscribe, leave a comment and a rating if they ask you for that. It's really important not only for us to find you, but for the platforms to know our program is worth their while. You can watch us on YouTube, Heard Tell YouTube channel. Goes right to it if you want to watch us in glorious 1070 HD. I prefer that you turn it down to 720, though, because I really have a face for radio. But you can watch us if you want to. We sure appreciate it. Same thing. Make sure you subscribe. Hit that notification. You'll never miss a thing. And leave us comments. We love getting comments, and we do interact with those. Heardtell.substack.com. One-stop shopping. Heard Tell Show on the Twitter. We're never going to call it X. Sorry, Elon. Deal with it. Heardtellshow@gmail.com. You want to email us the old-fashioned way, we'd love to hear from you. Let folks know. We don't do any advertising outside of our own social media. If you would put us on your social media with some links, we'd really appreciate it. So until we hear from you again on Heard Tell, wherever you are, across the street or around the world, whoever you're with, we hope you are well. We hope you're well-fed. We'll talk to you again real soon for more Heard Tell. Take care. All the music on Heard Tell is provided under a Creative Content license from MonsterCat.com. Somos la máquina.